everybody. Is this your first time for one of my sessions, anybody? Okay, so I will introduce myself again. I feel like I keep doing this all week. For the three of you, I'm Elizabeth Marshall. I'm a family practice physician, and I'm two-thirds of the way through a master's in theology. And I do a lot of work with medical ethics, end of life, and my greatest area of interest is the overlap between medicine and theology when it comes to human suffering. So that's where this whole, everything I've done this week has come from, really. But today is different because today, for me, is an opportunity to learn from all of you, I think, because I have a lot of observations about grief and lamenting our losses from being a physician and from sort of being an American, I think. And so I have a lot of thoughts that I want to share, but I also think that I have a lot more to learn. This is probably the one topic all week that isn't just sort of fully fleshed out in my mind. So I'm looking forward to how our discussion. So this for me is more of a discussion than really a lecture. So I just thought I'd start with a scripture from Isaiah. He is a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And I thought about that a lot. Acquainted with grief. What does it mean to be acquainted with grief? You know, that we, as a society, I think we've lost a sense of being acquainted with grief. We sort of put it on the back burner, or we don't think about it, or we don't understand it. And so to me, to be fully alive and fully Christian, really, is to be acquainted with grief, like Jesus was. So that's sort of kind of the underground. The top of it as a physician for me is what I see happening to people who don't know how to grieve. And we'll talk about that more, but how the loss of the ability to grieve leads to other problems, I think. So first, let's just talk about, first, the definition of lamentation or lament is a passionate expression of grief. So lament is like this extreme grief. And then for the definition of grief, of which there are many, is anguish, heartache, deep sorrow, or sadness after a loss. So lamenting is just this really intensely passionate expression of anguish and heartache. So first, I just want us to talk about, and I'm going to write up here what you guys say, the sources of grief in your life and in society. And this isn't meant to be a therapy session. So it's not, my grandmother died, and it could be, but it's not. So what I want to do is I want us to step back from our personal experience in a way and kind of put it out there and talk about grief and grieving in more of a, so we understand it, we experience it. But so when we talk about sources of grief, I want you to sort of be general about it, not specific, if that's okay. Yeah.
I would say that any change involves loss.
Yes.
Even if that's a change for something that,
yes,
quote unquote, if you get married, yes, it's wonderful, but it's a loss of privacy or, you know, whatever. Going to college, but there's any change involves loss.
Absolutely.
And I think the loss comes from judgment.
Yeah.
It also is for gain as well.
Gain?
You know, it's both and, isn't it?
Oh, you mean a change is for gain?
A change is for both gain and loss.
Yes, absolutely.
The loss may be...
like getting married.
Some loss may be more difficult, but it's still... You
There's
don't know
a gain
what to,
in
yeah.
that change, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Other sources of grief?
When things don't turn out like you thought they would.
Mm-hmm. So expectations, like failed expectations, maybe?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or at least different expectations than what you thought.
Unmet.
Yeah, even if you didn't
unmet.
Have
there
those
you go.
Expectations, or you were not aware of those expectations.
Yeah.
And when it comes around,
okay,
all of a sudden you're a failed
loss, death.
Death.
Of a loved one.
How about when you read the newspaper? Does anyone grieve when they pick up the newspaper? Yeah. So for me, there's grief, and I don't know quite how to phrase that, but you know, there are days I just go, I can't read the newspaper, because I know it's hard, it's difficult, I have to grieve to read the newspaper. So what would that be? It would be like society or something?
Or news or something.
Tragedy.
Injustice.
Injustice. Tragedy. Another one that after I went to Peter's talk on climate change and global warming, you know, like we were all just like, and we talked about how we have to grieve over the environment and over the planet and over, and that's a source of grief for me. I grew up in the Northwest and the salmon ran free and it cost $1 a pound, you know, and we could hike wherever we wanted, and now we have to have permits and the salmon are dying off. So I just would say there's an environmental, sort of a global source of grief. If that makes sense.
Yeah, there's also external events that one has an emotional investment in. I'm from Vancouver, BC, and there was a major riot after a lost hockey game.
Wasn't that dumb?
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it when I read that one. Yeah, so how would you phrase that? That's a source of grief just because maybe that gets back to society?
It might. I mean, one might argue that things like, say, 9/11 also fall into that category.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You may not be directly affected by it, but...
Events out of our control. How about that? Events out of our control.
And I also wanted to talk about, you know, there's sources of grief that in our society, like for instance, because I delivered babies for so many years, miscarriage. Miscarriage is a source of grief that women can't talk about to a great degree. Abortion is another one. I have many patients who grieve the fact that they had an abortion. They can't do that openly. I think sometimes when men lose a job, because I feel like the job thing is so important for men in particular, but that's a huge source of grief, or loss of respect, or loss of status in a community. I mean, there's lots of things that cause grief that we sort of don't have permission to talk about. So there's these hidden things, and there's more open things. So now, speaking, oh yeah.
Well, and there's cumulative grief.
Oh, cumulative, yeah, what do you mean?
Well, I know that happens in my profession with oncology nursing, and I think oncology physicians too, where you have multiple deaths of patients that you know and have built a relationship around, and each one affects you a little, but it, after a while, it will be one that will just tip you over, and you know, you lose your balance a bit. So there's cumulative.
That's really true. That's a very good point.
There's also anticipatory grief, where you're
anticipatory,
where you know your father's dying or whatever. You know there's loss coming.
Mm-hmm.
Anticipating. Mm-hmm.
And there was a hand back there somewhere. Was there? No.
Loss of freedom. I'm thinking about when my children were little, I could let them go to the park a half block away. Well, with my grandchildren now, even when they got to be 12 or 13, I wouldn't let them go alone. And my, you know, it's a lo- I don't know what I would, loss of safety, maybe. I don't
loss
know.
Of safety and change in society.
And maybe that's part of society as well.
Yeah, but loss of safety. Yeah.
And we didn't used to lock the doors when I was growing up.
Yeah,
but
neither did we.
So.
Yeah.
Loss of control.
What about being alone?
Loneliness. I think abandonment is really the biggest one, mm-hmm. really, abandonment. Okay, so now what I want you to do is just for a few minutes, just with people near you, you know, three people or so, I want you to talk about 9/11 And I want you to talk about the healthy ways that we grieved as a nation. What you saw, what you experienced that you felt helped you grieve. And then what you think was unhealthy about the way we reacted and responded to that as a nation. Because there are healthy ways to respond to loss and there are unhealthy ways. And I think that 9/11 is a great example of both of those things. And just a personal experience of a positive way was for me was that the Seattle Center has a huge fountain. It's a huge fountain that you can actually walk down into. And they turned off the fountain and they had this period of time where you could go and lay flowers and photographs and things in the fountain. And I went down there and it was the most remarkable experience because it was every color, every race, every everything, walking in a line in this circular down into the fountain. The fountain was lit full of flowers and photographs. And it was just this very beautiful experience of grieving in a really community way. And that helped me process what happened with 9/11. So I just want you to just talk about what are the healthy aspects of that, or what were they, what, you know, and then what was unhealthy about it. So just a little groups there.
Well, we're sitting next to each other.
How come in here?
Okay, I'm going to read what my group came up with. Healthy responses were action, contact with people you love, asking why, self-reflection and exploration, turning to the spiritual, more church services, and in a positive way, patriotism because it was bringing people together. Unhealthy patriotism because it was excluding. Anger, blame, attacking, a sick fascination in the media. I had a great group. This is all from them. Generalizations about people, a lack of self-reflection, paranoia, fear, revenge, name-calling, suspicion, and cynicism. So we unfortunately came up with more unhealthy responses than healthy. I would like to point out that if nations don't grieve, for instance, if you don't grieve the Holocaust, what happens? You don't remember it. If you don't grieve racism, if you don't grieve, you know. And what Vivian said last night struck me, the difference between shame and guilt.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, guilt, I made a mistake, I'm responsible for it. Shame, I am a mistake. And that when we're truly guilty, we need to grieve. But shame isn't a source or a reason for grief. So the effects of ungrieved grief. Now I'm going to throw out what I see as a physician, and I would love us to also talk about what those effects would be. But I can tell you a story about a guy who came in, and he was coming in for, he wanted a blood test for his stomach for something called Helicobacter. It's a bacteria. And he wasn't my patient, and he was about 28. And all he wanted was his blood test. He'd read about it, and he wanted it. And so I started asking questions, and he said, well, for 10 years I've been vomiting after every time I eat. And I said, oh, really? I looked through his chart, and he had indeed had more upper GI, lower GI, you know, every kind of invasive test that known to man, been sent to all these specialists. And I'm like, and no one, you know, so no one's ever found out why you've been vomiting after you eat. And he goes, no. And so I said, well, tell me a little bit more about this. And he said, well, it started after I gained 90 pounds in a year. And I was like, well, why did you gain 90 pounds in a year? And he said, well, I ate fast food straight for a year. He was addicted to fast food. And then he stopped fast food, lost all the weight, but got addicted to alcohol. and then he stopped drinking the alcohol. And meanwhile, I'm thinking, there is some, so I'm like, well, tell me a little bit more. Tell me a little bit more. What led you to, you know, the fast food? And he finally told me this story. He said, well, when I was 9, my mother had Huntington's disease, and I was changing her diapers at the age of 9. I had 3 older siblings, and they all got hooked on drugs. So I had to take care of my 4 younger siblings and change my mother's diapers. And she died when I was 16. And then he said, he was from New Jersey. He said, I was coming out of a ball game. I took my younger brother to a ball game in New Jersey. And this guy, who apparently was a drive-by shooter, had a, I'm sorry, I don't know those weapons, where you can like kill a lot of people. What's that called? Yeah, and he killed 16 people like this. And ran out of ammo at this guy and his brother. And he told me all this, and I just said, you have so much grief in your life and so much loss. And he's like, oh, I never really thought about that. And I mean, he had never identified that he had this huge emotional burden that he was carrying in his life. And he recognized that he needed to process it. I said, let's do your blood test. So we did the blood test, and it was positive, which wasn't the cause of his vomiting. But he realized, you know, the reason for his addictions, the reason for the whole thing was really unresolved or unexpressed grief. That he's a person who needed to tell his story, and he needed some good counseling, and he needed to just work with it. So I, as a physician, see that unexpressed grief causes chronic illness in people. And I do need to flip that and say, I don't think, because I had this conversation with Carol, I don't think that means we can never be sick if we do everything right emotionally. But I do think we can certainly help ourselves by identifying our sorrows and our losses and grieving them. But I'm wondering what else you think, you know, in your own experience, if you've, you know, what the inability to grieve your losses might lead to. You know, if you always pretend everything's okay, or if you always try to be the strong one, or if you, do you know what I'm getting at here? Because our society really focuses on this positive thing. But what might be the downside of that? Any thoughts?
I think it might come out at an inopportune time or something.
Yep.
You know, and it might come out more forcefully than what maybe a little grieving here and here and here and here go.
Yep. I think that's really true. Mm-hmm.
I think it might turn into anger.
Anger, I totally agree.
Yeah. We see this with 9/11. Anger.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to suggest, though, that anger is a natural response to grief. It's part of the grieving process. I think the anger is okay. It's how what you do with that anger. Mm-hmm. The anger becomes bitterness. Of anger
bitterness.
Becomes prejudice. It becomes.
Yep.
Exclusive, you know, scapegoating. But the anger, you know, you'll see people experience a lot of anger in grief.
I think
and that's part.
I think bitterness is part of it. Yeah.
A lot of people have a hard time, including myself, with people in anger in grief. It's hard. It's hard to be around because it's often directed at the wrong person. It's directed at someone, and it's not, you know, you're mad at the doctor when your husband is very ill. You're mad at the nurse, you know, I mean, a lot of times medical professionals end up getting a lot of the anger.
Right. Mm-hmm. And attack is another one, mm-hmm. back to 9/11. Mm-hmm. And you had said, just like it sort of comes out unexpectedly, or you said that. Mm-hmm. Unexpected.
Outburst, I think.
Yeah. Unexpected outburst.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about depression? I see depression huge.
Yeah.
People don't.
Yeah, speak with capital letters.
Yeah, depression. Okay, what else? Back there.
I was going to say despair or loss of hope.
Loss of hope, despair. That's such a good one.
I think you avoid intimacy. You have these barriers up to keep yourself contained, and it's hard to open up. Or
Isolation.
Isolation.
Yeah, really true. I think of that, yeah. I like to think of the story of Lazarus as someone who's in his tomb. His tomb is suffering. His tomb is grief. And he has to choose to stand up and come out when Jesus calls, you know. So those are just a few things, but we definitely, I do believe that not being able to grieve impacts us emotionally and physically and spiritually. And I think the antidepressant use in the United States is in part, not in whole by any means, but in part because we don't grieve. And I've certainly had people come in and say, I want an antidepressant. And when I start asking them questions, I discover they're grieving about something and they just need to grieve.
I was just gonna say, I think part of that oneness, though, is because we as a society don't allow people to do that. We don't encourage it, and we don't allow it, and we teach our children and the people around us that you don't, you know, that you keep that to yourself or you keep that contained.
Okay, that's my perfect segue. My next thing for you to talk about in your group is, what were the childhood messages you got from your parents? Okay, for me it was grin and bear it. That's what my mother said. Grin and bear it.
So, can I just one thing?
Yeah.
What about people who have, say a spouse who's ill for quite a long time?
Yeah.
They've already started the grieving, mm-hmm. and so when this actually happens, the grief is pretty much, it hasn't totally worked through, but they seem to bounce back maybe a little quicker then.
Mm-hmm. And that's why a slow death is better for the loved ones than
right,
a quick
yeah.
death.
But
absolutely.
That, yeah.
And there's a relief, usually, if someone's been
right.
ill
yeah.
for a long time yeah. because it's over. And that's all very, and healthy.
Yeah.
Healthy. But and that is why that the sudden death is so awful, or the death of a child, the unexpected
right.
death
yeah.
is definitely the hardest. Yeah, but just share for just a few minutes with each other what messages, maybe you've got really healthy messages. Which would be, share those. But just do that, because I think it's good for us to look at that. And I was told, I remember
somebody really close.
Okay, so what I want to do now is look at the messages we have from the Bible about grieving. In contrast to maybe the messages, good or negative, I think, like, she had pretty good experience right here. Which is why she's an oncology nurse and has run a hospice, I think, because she can grieve. But that's an unusual thing. So, first of all, have you ever thought about the fact that there's a whole book of the Bible titled Lamentations?
Yes.
The whole thing is a lament when Jerusalem was sacked. It's written about 586 BC. And the amazing thing is, first of all, it's a lament, and it's in there purposefully, I think, to teach us how to lament. But the second thing is, they are lamenting their sin. They're lamenting the fact that Jerusalem was sacked, and they directly attribute that to an act of God because of the sin of the Jewish people. And I think Lamentations, in part, tells us it is perfectly okay to grieve deeply over your own sin. So if you drink Coca-Cola and eat chocolate bars and you get diabetes, it is totally okay to go to God and say, I am really mad that I have diabetes, even though it's a result of me not taking care of myself. Like, there's never a legitimate reason not to come to God with your complaint, in a sense. I think that's what Lamentations tells us. The book of Job is also a lament, and Job was righteous. So I feel like in those two examples, we have this beautiful contrast of, you know, you lament when things happen to you that are out of your control. And you lament when things happen to you even if they're in your control. That we have that permission. What I really want to look at is a lament psalm. And I'm going to pass this out here. It's two-sided. We're going to look at Psalm 22. Because I think the lament psalms teach us how to lament. And this was written by David, who, of course, was kind of a naughty boy. And
he was lamenting, you know, his.
One more.
Oh, I think they're back there. He passed on that. And I want.
She needs one more.
We have one more up here? Okay, there we go. I want us to actually, we need four groups. Because we're going to read this. And so the classic lament psalm, which I think does teach us how to lament, starts with an invocation. You frequently, it's Lord in capital letters, meaning Yahweh, but it's a way of calling on God. You're God. I'm calling on you right now. And then it tends to go to a recollection of who God is, what God has done in the past, how God behaves, how God has been faithful or good or reliable in the past. Like that was then, that's not now, but that's then. And then there's a lament. And when you look at the lament, when you really read these laments, like in Lamentations, where it talks about the mothers being forced to eat their children, they get into the details. This one gets into the details. That's why I chose it. And then there's a plea for help. And in this one, the recollection, lament, and plea sort of go back and forth. And then at the end, there's a vow of praise to God. This is why David was David. Because it starts with God, and it ends with God. And in the middle is all the complaints, but it's saying, no matter what, you're still God. I'm starting and I'm ending with you, God, in spite of all this stuff happening. So I wanted us to read this, and I want us to do, I'll do the invocation, and maybe this group can be the recollection group. And then you guys back there can be the lament group, and then you guys here will be the plea group, and then you guys will do the last whole section that's the vow of praise, okay? So I will start, and just listen to this. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from my cries of anguish? My God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer, by night, but I find no rest. Yet you are enthroned as the Holy One. You are the one Israel praises. And now.
And you, who our ancestors put their trust, they trusted and you delivered them. To them they cried out and were saved. In you they trusted and were not put to shame.
But I am a worm and not a man, scorned by everyone, despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. He trusts in the Lord, they say. Let the Lord rescue him. Let him deliver him, since his life is in him.
Yet you brought me out of the womb. You made me trust in you, even at my mother's breast. From birth I was cast on you. From my mother's womb you have been God.
Do not be far from me, for the trouble is near, and there is no one to help.
Many wolves surround me, strong wolves of Bashan encircle me, roaring lions that tear their prey, open their mouths wide against me. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart has turned to wax, it has melted within me. My mouth is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. Dogs surround me. A pack of villains encircles me. They pierce my hands and my feet. All my bones are on display. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my clothes among them and cast lots for my garment.
But you, Lord, do not be far from me. You are my strength. Come quickly to help me. Deliver me from the sword, my precious life from the power of the dogs. Rescue me from the mouth of the lions. Save me from the horns of the wild oxen.
I will declare your name to my people. In the assembly I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All your descendants of Jacob, honor him. Revere him, all your descendants of Israel. For he has not despised or scorned the suffering of the afflicted one. He has not hidden his face from him, but has listened to his cry for help. From you comes the theme of my praise in the great assembly. Before those who fear you, I will fulfill my vows. The poor will eat and be satisfied. Those who seek the Lord will praise him. May your hearts live forever. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will bow down before him. For dominion belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations. All the rich of the earth will feast and worship. All who get down to the dust will kneel before him. Those who cannot keep themselves alive, posterity will serve him. Future generations will be told about the Lord. They will proclaim his righteousness, declaring to a people yet unborn, he has done it.
So what I love here is you see, I mean, my favorite one is my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. Like my bones are out of joint. My heart has turned to wax. He is telling God everything. My lips are dry. My joints hurt. My hip is aching. I don't know. You know, he's basically saying, you know, people are surrounding me. I mean, he's really giving God the details of his emotional person. And the other amazing thing is that the praise section is as long as the lament section, if you put them all together, and longer. And when you think of the, you know, when he says, you lay me in the dust of death, and then he says, all the rich of the earth will feast and worship, all who go down to the dust will kneel before him, those who cannot keep themselves alive. So he's really setting his suffering in the context of God. And I think that gave him comfort. And I think he also felt known by God because he lamented. He told God his pain. And I think he told God his pain not as we tend to do, putting ourselves first. We tend to make our pain more important than God. But this type of lamentation, you're taking God first and telling him all your pain in the context of who God is. And the best example, I mean, my husband and I have really worked on kind of practicing this kind of form of Psalms prayer where you just sort of start with God. But the example I can give is our daughter, who's up here with me, when she was 13 years old, was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. Because I'm a physician, I, you know, like saw my daughter in a wheelchair by the time she was 20. I mean, it was very, very hard for me, and I was grieving absolutely deeply, waking up in the middle of the night crying. You know, I didn't want her to see me grieving because I didn't want her to, like, know what I was thinking. But when we prayed, we could say, you know, when you start off with sort of who God is, you can be very specific. God, you made Barrett. You made her beautiful. You made her active. You made her leap and jump and sing and da-da-da-da. And then you pour out your lament. Why are you doing this? I'm angry. I'm sad. I don't, you know, you pour out your lament. And then you say, help her, help her, help her. And you are God. We praise you no matter what. And I'll tell you what, that prayer, that way of praying, first we felt comfort because we knew that God created Barrett. Do you know what I mean? You start off with who God is and suddenly you take that situation and you see it in the light of God instead of in the light of your little earthly. It's just this, it's very, very healing way of praying out your grievances or even your joys. I mean, we pray that way now in lots of different circumstances, so it can be positive ones too. But and I would encourage you to just try writing your own lament, you know, writing your own psalm of lament and sort of practice it so you really get the idea. Start with God and be really specific. So if you know someone who has cancer, you can do this for other people too, but you know, you can be very specific about God. You made the pancreas. You know how it runs, you know, you understand the pancreas. And then, you know, why have you given pancreatic cancer? Why does so-and-so, you know what I mean? You can be very specific in who God is and in your grievance. Let me go back to here. Now, I wanted to just point out that I believe there will be an end to lament, that Scripture promises us there'll be an end to lament when God will wipe every tear from the eye. And that's very reassuring in the context of our human lamenting. I also wanted to, as a physician, just go over the symptoms of grieving so that you know them. Because sometimes people come in and don't know them. The classic symptoms of grieving are loss of appetite, sleeplessness, inability to sleep, unexpected memories, usually, you know, this could be a your boyfriend broke up with you. I mean, this doesn't have to be a death. But sometimes I remember the Northwest the way it used to be. And it's hard for me when I see the population density. So unexpected memories from the past, a loss of interest in things when you're really acutely grieving. You know, it's hard to get out of bed, or it might be hard to want to engage with life. That's very common. That's not depression, that's grief. Crying is very, very healthy. Very, very healthy. Today, just for fun, I did this search where I just put the word tears into Bible Gateway. And, you know, there are thousands of scriptures with the word tears in them. I mean, we are created to cry. God made us to weep. Jesus wept. It's my favorite verse in the Bible. Jesus wept. You know, it's just like tears are so important. We need to cry. So those are the really common symptoms. And they can overlap with depression. And so there's that whole thing of, is this grief or is this depression? If there's been a loss and you're feeling those things, that's normal grief. You can't sleep at night. The one thing that I do for my patients who are really grieving is I give them a sleeping pill, because usually for about 2 weeks, because you do need to sleep to cope with, especially if there's a funeral or things like that. You need that. Also, we need the community. And I think that we can't be abandoned to our grief. And I think that the church has a major role. If you look, I have a friend who's Jewish, who he's very, very involved in his synagogue. And when his father died, I envied him, actually, because they have a very clear time where they say, you have the services, you have certain prayers you pray, you have, I think it was a week or 9 days, where you don't go to work, everyone comes around, they sit with you, they visit you, your community, it's just the way they do it. And then at the end of that, you go back to work. Now the assumption isn't, oh, I'm done grieving, but it's that it's time to re-engage. And when I talked to Mike, who was so close to his dad, he just said it was lovely, the way the community, we rail against the whole Jewish law thing, but in this sense, it was like a structure that gave him comfort. And I think as a church, you know, you think about the Irish wakes where the women all wail and mourn or whatever. Like there's a positive role, I think, to that we've lost in our society, that there is a time for grieving. And if we can remember that and come around one another in that process, or write a psalm of lament for your friend and give it to them. You know, like to participate with them in their grieving. I think it's something we can do better at, I'll put it that way. And so that's why, you know, how many of you have been to a funeral? Like when my dad died, some of my kindergarten classmates showed up because they read about it in the paper. Mm-hmm. And I could not believe what it meant to me to see them. I just went, oh my gosh, you know, my community has turned out in this unexpected way. And unfortunately, in America, we tend to go to the funeral and everyone goes back to life and you're supposed to be sort of okay. So remembering as a church to kind of check in and be present to people, I think, is really important. So that's what I have to say. Are there any thoughts or questions or... You're smiling. Why are you smiling?
This is just, I think it's good for us to be able to recognize that not only to have a license to be able to grieve, but to empower others to have their grief. When you were looking at the list that's just right above the invocation list, that I would add to that that sometimes inability to grieve provides some sort of creates an emotional paralysis.
Yeah.
The person is just immobilized. And they simply can't, they have no direction as to which way to move and how to heal, how to connect with others. And it's just, it is a personal help to be in that place. So for us who are able to empower and to recognize and to give people license to grieve, it was mentioned in the room, there's another one. We have this season when we're ready for a person's grief to be over.
Absolutely.
And we're like,
so
okay,
true.
We need to get on with this.
Yeah.
We buried him. We really need to move on. We don't want to hear those stories anymore. We don't want to be in that place. And everyone has different seasons of grief. I think that if we can recognize that, it can really help to foster healthy communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think one of the best explanations that kind of tags on to that in that people think, okay, you grieve, the bad part is over, the worst part is over, and therefore it just tapers off or whatever. And the best way that I heard it described, and it was about a family who lost a child, is that it's more like wavelength.
Yeah.
And it's like where you feel it acutely, and then it might go down, but then it comes back who knows when, and then it will go down. And that's more of the grieving process. It's not like that.
That's very
and then you'll be normal.
Yeah.
Because you're changed forever.
Right. Mm-hmm. I also think that for me, when I've had things to grieve, that it increases your joy in life too. I was thinking about when Barrett was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. I just kind of went into this space for weeks where I was just grieving. And we live on Puget Sound, and there's whales that come every April, and they're gray whales from California, and they blow and they eat shrimp. And I just remember one day in the midst of this sorrow, I looked up and the whales were back and they were blowing. And I still remember this moment of going, the world is going on. And this deep gratitude for the whales. It's like this joy in knowing that in spite of it all, the world was going on outside of me. You know, and there was like this, I don't know how to explain it, but this joy in the seasons and the migration of the whales. And I think that there's that thing of when you grieve, you also experience joy. I think our society is sort of blunted, and I think why antidepressants are sad to me in some ways is they blunt us in some ways, you know. But I think we're meant to experience joy, and I think we're meant to experience grief, and I think they go hand in hand. And yeah.